Good morning. It's 11 minutes before the hour on this Tuesday, the 8th day of May, 2012. I'm Jeff Seifert for Raven News. The Sitka Assembly will accept the resignation of member Terry Blake when it meets in regular session tonight. The Assembly will also hear on first reading an ordinance raising water rates, the first of many municipal rate increases expected to come this year. Blake announced that he was stepping down at the last Assembly meeting. He told his colleagues that he and his family were returning to the lower 48 to be closer to aging relatives in the Southwest. Blake is a physician's assistant at Mount Edgecombe Hospital. His wife, Susie, is a physician there. The couple has two sons. They have lived in Sitka for 6 years. The Assembly now has 20 days to fill Blake's seat. The replacement will serve until the municipal election on October 9th, when voters will elect a candidate to serve out the remainder of Blake's one-year term. Practice in the past has been for the Assembly to appoint a runner-up in a municipal election to an empty seat, but the panel broke with that tradition in the fall of 2010 when it appointed Peter Squiro to fill the seat vacated by Cheryl Westover after she moved to the mayor's chair. The Assembly appointed Esquiro over incumbent Jack Osmond, who won 23% of the vote for third in 2010. The runner-up in 2011 was former city administrator Gary Paxton, who lost a write-in contest with Phyllis Hackett by 53 votes. Again, the Assembly may appoint any qualified Sitkin to serve in Blake's place until the election in October. The Assembly will also hear on first reading an ordinance raising water rates. The increase to the base rate will be about $3.30 per month. Metered water service for large consumers will also increase. The water rate increase was the first of four rate increases proposed by the Finance Department during a budget work session last week. A proposal for raising electrical rates will be introduced at a budget work session on Monday, May 21st. New mortgage rates will be discussed by the Port and Harbors Commission on May 24th. The Sitka Assembly meets at 6 p.m. this evening. Raven Radio will provide live coverage beginning at that time. The State Ferry Matanuska collided with a seafood processing dock in Petersburg early yesterday afternoon. There were no reported injuries, but there was substantial damage to the Ocean Beauty Seafood Facility. There were also some dents in the bow of the ferry above the waterline, though she tied up safely at the terminal shortly after the incident and later continued on her way. State and federal transportation officials are investigating what happened. Matt Lichtenstein has more.
The Matanuska was carrying 60 passengers at the time. One of them was Petersburg resident John Bringhurst, who was surprised there wasn't more of a jolt when the 408-foot ship hit the seafood plant.
Well, we were up front and we're just kind of waiting to pull into the dock, and my wife called my attention to the fact that it looked like we were headed for the wrong dock. As I looked out the front of the ferry, I could see that we were headed right for Ocean Beauty, and there seemed to be no deterrent from that course. And as we came in a little closer, you could hear the reverse thrusters coming on, and I just told everybody to sit down that we might have an abrupt halt there, and sure enough, we rammed into the back of the Ocean Beauty dock there. Wasn't all that big of an impact, though. We just kind of bounced off and went on our way, so it wasn't that difficult for the passengers on board.
No one was out on the Ocean Beauty dock itself when the accident occurred. The impact smashed in a significant portion of the wood and concrete dock, as well as the waterfront face of the building itself, which includes the residents upstairs. One of the company's large cranes fell most of the way through the damaged dock. Broken pilings swayed in the tide. The Matanuska had been heading southbound for Petersburg's downtown ferry terminal when the accident occurred. She was heard blasting her horn multiple times just beforehand. Jim Spignazzi watched it from a different seafood processor's dock.
Shortly after, a couple minutes after 1 o'clock, we were watching the Matanuska come in, and it started kind of wildly turning to the port side. And I thought I was going to start going down towards the transient dock.
Instead of hitting Petersburg's North Harbor floats, he said the Matanuska hit Ocean Beauty. Department of Transportation spokesperson Jeremy Woodrow said the Marine Highway notified the Coast Guard right away. According to Woodrow, it was too early to say what caused the accident.
It would just be speculation until we do a real complete investigation, interview all the parties that are involved, and make sure that, you know, we have all of our bases covered before we actually, you know, point a finger at what may have been the cause, whether it was a person or it was, you know, mechanical malfunction.
After examining the damage to the bow, Woodrow said the Coast Guard cleared the Matanuska to continue on her voyage at 4 p.m. Monday. She was scheduled to head south to Wrangell and then Ketchikan. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
While the national parks are called often the America's greatest idea, a few Alaskans might think there's an even better one. Alaska's Permanent Fund Dividend, Exploring Its Suitability as a Model, is the dry-sounding title of a new book about a very popular topic, the annual check every Alaskan receives just for living here. Published by the Academic Division of Macmillan, Alaska's Permanent Fund Dividend is comprised of papers by scholars from around the world. Three of the book's authors are from Alaska. One headed the legislative staff that created the dividend in 1982. KCAW's Robert Woolsey recently spoke with the former Sitka municipal attorney, Cliff Groh, about his contribution to the book.
People sometimes introduce me when I speak as someone who helped create the permanent fund, and I always correct them and say, all I did to create the permanent fund was to be one of the tens of thousands of Alaska voters who voted for it when it was on the ballot as a constitutional amendment in 1976.
For Cliff Groh, the blurring of the permanent fund and the permanent fund dividend in the minds of many Alaskans is helping fuel a potential fiscal crisis in the state. The permanent fund, thanks to a younger Groh and other like-minded Alaskans, is now a part of the state's constitution. The dividend, on the other hand, was created by statute and isn't permanent at all. The legislature could kill it at any time, and one day they might have to. Groh headed up the legislative staff that created the dividend in 1982. It was no slam dunk. In fact, Groh says it took several failures to eventually get the checks moving.
It had, like many major historical events, all kinds of contingencies and close calls, both before its life and then even after in the first year of its existence. And it was pretty amazing when you look back on it, and that's why that first chapter is called The Improbable But True Story of How the Dividend Came to Be.
Groh collaborated with Juneau economist Greg Erickson on the book's first three chapters. They focused on the history and the mechanism of the dividend. Groh wrote another chapter solo, but that won't come out until the second volume is published later this summer. Groh's individual chapter looks at the dividend's end game, the likely scenarios surrounding the eventual decline of oil, and the probable politics of ending the dividend. Groh is proud of his role in creating the dividend, but he admits that it was a policy of plenty when there seemed to be no end in sight to Alaska's oil wealth.
A lot of the way the permanent fund got created and the permanent fund dividend was from a very much a feeling of surplus and trying to decide what to do with all the money before a lot of the demands for other purposes and other uses had gotten so strong and so institutionalized.
Those demands and institutions were not far behind the creation of the dividend. Groh thinks that if the dividend had not passed in 1982 and instead was up for a vote, say, 5 years later, we never would have had a dividend. Groh first wrote a history of the dividend program shortly after it was created. In 1997, he wrote an update to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the permanent fund itself. Despite a heavy cover price, Groh is getting no payment for this new work. The book is an exercise in scholarship, and Groh says he contributed to help people understand how we got here and how the dividend works on a basic level. He doesn't think clear decisions can be made without either. He believes the next major decisions about the fund and the dividend should be made with a longer view.
I do think people need to think clearly about that and think about the choices in a more explicit way and in a more real-life way, not which so many politicians seem to suggest, hey, you know, it'll all be okay in the long run because we'll, we'll find a bunch of oil in Anwar, we'll open it up, and then it'll all be groovy.
Groh and Erickson are the only non-academics contributing to the book. The third Alaskan author was University of Alaska Anchorage Professor Scott Goldsmith. Alaska's Permanent Fund Dividend is available where academic texts are sold. It retails on Amazon for $85. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Author Cliff Groh is an attorney now in private practice in Anchorage. He writes the Alaska Political Corruption blog. You can find a link on our website, kcaw.org. Here's a different approach to hydropower generation from the Pacific Northwest. It's not about damming rivers. Instead, it's about building long earthen dams to make new off-stream hydropower reservoirs. They're being designed to act as giant batteries and shock absorbers for the electric grid. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Portland, Oregon.
Here's an odd thought that relates to keeping your lights burning steady and bright. Someday, a small portion of your electricity bill could go toward pumping water in a loop. Lots of water, pumped uphill, run back downhill, then pump back uphill again. Enterprising energy developers have at least 7 places in the Northwest in mind for projects of this type. Eric Stimley is shepherding a proposal for 2 reservoirs near Klamath Falls, one up on a plateau connected to another down below in the valley.
It's a large reclamation project, yes. Hundreds of workers on site. You know, the construction project would likely take place over the course of years. A large project.
Stimley works in the Portland regional office of energy developer Riverbank Power. On the office walls are renderings of what in the biz they call a pumped storage hydropower project. Stimley gets help explaining how it works from Ellis Arzu of joint venture partner Enexco.
On energy generation, what we're talking about is a simple arbitrage between pumping using low-cost energy, so basically off-peak, and basically generating the energy at peak hours of the day.
In other words, the good old Wall Street principle of buy low, sell high. But Arzu says that alone doesn't net much money, given this region's generally low electricity prices. So the developers are marketing their project as a grid stability service. They propose to make most of their money billing utilities for backing up or balancing the volatile, irregular output of the Northwest's burgeoning fleet of wind farms.
That's a reporter Tom Bonsi reporting.